Case number 19-5894, USA v. Timothy Gowder, 19-5911, 19-5943, and 19-6032. USA v. Anwar Mithavani, James Combs, Pete Tyndale. Argument not to exceed 30 minutes per side. Mr. Samuel, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Don Samuel. I represent Anwar Mithavani. Mr. Mithavani was convicted in the Eastern District of Kentucky of conspiring to distribute oxycodone and oxymorphone. Several money laundering counts were premised on these illegal drug distribution charge. He was sentenced by the district court to 25 years in prison. It hardly needs to be stressed that conspiracy trials, at which multiple defendants are charged, pose significant dangers to individuals who are tried together and risk being convicted based on the conduct of co-defendants. And it goes without saying that urging an appellate court to reverse a conviction on sufficiency grounds is not frequently a successful endeavor. Nevertheless, this case exemplifies the unjust results that can occur with joint trials, and we urge the court to review the evidence in this case and conclude that there was insufficient evidence to support Mr. Mithavani's convictions. For several weeks during the winter of 2019, Mr. Mithavani stood trial, accused of knowingly conspiring to distribute oxycodone and oxymorphone from a pain management clinic. He was tried along with the two doctors who were at the clinic, who were obviously aware of precisely how they treated patients and the drugs that they prescribed. He was tried along with a patient who was actually a drug dealer. And he was tried along with his business partner who had experience with pain management clinics previously in Florida. Yet there is no doubt, no dispute, that Mr. Mithavani is not a doctor, had no experience with any medical clinic whatsoever prior to investing in the Tennessee clinic, to say nothing of a pain management clinic, never met, talked to, or had any dealings with any patient involved at the Tennessee Pain Institute. He was the quintessential absentee owner who lived nearly 1,000 miles away from the scene of the crime, who came to Tennessee at most, according to the undisputed evidence, 2 or 3 days per year. There's no dispute. The government does not contest these facts that we documented in both our principal and reply brief. Mr. Mithavani has no medical training of any kind. He never saw or had any communication with any patient at the Tennessee Pain Institute. He never made any clinical decisions, never had any role whatsoever in making medical decisions for any patient. He never directed any doctor how to treat a patient or whether to prescribe any drugs, to say nothing of opioids. He never had any knowledge.
Is there evidence that your client had any involvement in hiring any of the employees of TPI?
He was involved in hiring the employees at the early stages when the clinic first opened, but he never lived there. He was just making sure that staff were qualified. The doctors were qualified. Dr. Moore, Dr. Gowder were both qualified MDs. And the nurses and staff who manned the clinic day by day for years were qualified people, and the government never contested that fact. In fact, they were government witnesses who testified about the operation of the clinic during the period of time. And Mr. Mithavani, according to every member of the staff, spent a total of 2 or maybe 3 days per year at the clinic and had no involvement whatsoever in any of the operations from a clinical or medical standpoint.
Was he aware of the Tennessee Department of Health investigation of the doctors for their prescribed practices?
Yes, Dr. Bush. Yes, Judge Bush, he was aware. In fact, his company was the management company for the clinic, and he also was in charge of HR. And the evidence established that in that connection, he paid the attorney's fees for the two doctors. Once the doctors had, were sanctioned, the clinic closed down and there was no more involvement with them or with Mr. Mithavani in the Tennessee clinic.
Did the clinic continue to operate for a period while the investigation took place?
It did.
How long was that period?
Your Honor, I don't remember the exact number of months, but the investigation began with the other doctor, Dr. Gowder, but he was allowed to continue to practice medicine. The medical board did not stop him from practicing. And when he was eventually sanctioned, Dr. Moore then just conceded and didn't put up a defense and agreed to surrender his license, you know, for a brief period of time.
And then your client also was involved in moving the clinic to North Carolina once it had been shut down in Tennessee. Is that correct?
Well, you say he moved the clinic. After the clinic in Tennessee was shut down, he and Mr. Tyndale discussed opening a clinic in North Carolina. They talked to qualified doctors in Florida to come up and to run the clinic. It operated for a very brief period of time. And eventually the partnership fell apart and they did not continue the practice of medicine. But there was no allegation of illegality in North Carolina. Nobody was sanctioned up there. And the doctors who participated in the North Carolina clinic for, again, a very brief period of time, a matter of months, in some cases, a matter of days, were not sanctioned for any of the practices there.
Was your client the owner who told the employee that the laws are not as strict in North Carolina as they are in Tennessee?
He most certainly did. He told an employee that one of the reasons they were going to North Carolina is because the laws were less strict there. That's one of the reasons why the clinic was operating in Tennessee, in fact, because Kentucky had no pain clinics at the time. And the government stresses that fact and says, look at all these patients who came from Kentucky to Tennessee, when in fact, the doctors in Tennessee, all of these patients were required to be referred to the clinic by their treating physician. And the doctors in Kentucky were directing their patients, were providing referrals to their patients specifically to come to this clinic because there were no pain clinics available in Kentucky. And later, you know, Mr. Mithaviani, Mr. Tyndale decided to open up a clinic in North Carolina. Again, nothing illegal about that. They did want to go to an environment where the laws were less strict. I don't know any businessman who doesn't try to avoid more regulations. But the clinic, you know, they were not able to open up the clinic there. The government's argument in this case, the government's argument as to why the evidence was sufficient, you know, includes things like that Mr. Mithaviani, you know, while in Florida, you know, he spent the entire time in Florida, 1,000 miles away, that he was getting, a substantial amount of income. That's true. That's not denied. It was never contested at trial. Many businessmen make a lot of money, even more than their employees, even if their employees are doctors. They question the fact that so many patients came from Kentucky that he knew. But again, that's because that's where the referring doctors were. These patients were referred to TPI by their treating physicians, the exact opposite of what happens in a typical pill mill. And that's what he knew. The government claims that he should have been aware because there were complaint forms from patients, yet he was the one who directed that the clinic keep track of complaints so that he could see if there were any problems there. And then with regard to the complaint forms that were sent, there was no evidence that he actually read every one of them or was aware of what the complaints were, or more importantly, whether the complaints were dealt with by the staff that was up there. We point out also that inconsistent with pill mills, the hundreds of patients who applied to come to TPA were rejected. The exact opposite of what happens in a pill mill. The DEA expert agreed with that. That inconsistent with most pill mills, they discharged patients who tested positive on their urine screen for the wrong type of drugs, such as, you know, having methamphetamine or not having the drugs that were prescribed to them. They discharged those patients. The exact opposite of what happens to a pill mill. This is what Mr. Mithaviani knows. Mr. Mithaviani is not a doctor. He has no clinical experience. He didn't even know what patients were being treated with. He has no basis to have made it any understanding of what the, I'm sorry.
It almost sounds like from what you're saying, your client invested in a business that he knew almost nothing about. And thereafter,
fair enough.
Had virtually almost nothing to do with the management and running of it. Even though he was making enormous sums of money from the business, that all sounds a bit strange.
Judge Clay, it is true that he had no experience. It's true that he had no knowledge. There are many absentee owners of businesses who decide that a business can be profitable. It's not true that he had no management role. He had a substantial management role, but his management had nothing to do with treating patients. His management involved dealing with the finances of the operation.
He's not a doctor. He's not legally permitted to do that.
Well, that's correct. And he didn't. And that's why he shouldn't be held responsible as being a drug dealer. He was in charge of the taxes. He was in charge of the HR department. He was in charge of keeping track of revenue and patient records. I see my time has expired, and I would ask you to review the lengthy briefs that were filed.
You can quickly finish your thought if you need to.
Well, I guess I would just rely on the briefs, Your Honor, about extensively reviewed the absence of evidence of his participation in any clinical or medical decisions or any treatment of any patient. Never met a patient, never saw a patient. Maybe he's negligent. Maybe you think he shouldn't have been in charge of this business, but to sentence him to prison for the rest of his life is not the proper resolution. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Lazarus, that believe would be next.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, Jeff Lazarus, Federal Public Defenders, on behalf of Appellant Pete Tyndale. The district court in this case erred in permitting a large amount of testimony about a pill mill conspiracy in Florida at Mr. Tyndale's trial, which was improper other acts evidence under evidence rule 404B. His other acts evidence was merely guilt by association and improperly prejudiced Mr. Tyndale. The government put forth evidence that a proven pill mill conspiracy took place in Jacksonville, Florida, and that Mr. Tyndale had business connections to that clinic, but not that Mr. Tyndale did anything illegal or had any role in the conspiracy involving the illegal distribution of pills in there. Nonetheless, the government used evidence of the Florida conspiracy to imply that because Mr. Tyndale knew the people in that conspiracy and that he was involved in the conspiracy in Tennessee. This is classic inadmissible character evidence. The district court, however, failed to properly enforce the rule. The district court found the evidence presented by these multiple witnesses was permissible because it was, quote, relevant to knowledge. The district court, however, failed to provide any explanation as to what knowledge this referred to or provide any limitations on the government's ability to present this evidence. This allowed the prosecution to spend a significant portion of its case in chief against Mr. Tyndale, showing that he had business associations with the Florida pill mill in the hopes that the jury would conclude that he had done something wrong before, so he must be guilty in this case. The district court, in admitting this other acts evidence, also failed to conduct any balancing of the probative value and the prejudicial effect. The district court is required to conduct such balancing, even if it finds the other acts evidence falls into one of the permissible categories. So even if the other act evidence was relevant to knowledge, the district court should have still determined whether the prejudice outweighs the probative value. The district court did no such thing in this case. The district court merely held it was relevant and allowed all the evidence in. The district court also denied the defense's request to provide any limiting instruction to the jury about the use of this evidence, which is required by this court's precedents set forth in our brief, most specifically United States versus Merriweather and United States versus Johnson.
You know, there's an awful lot of evidence alleging that your client and his partner's counsel we just heard from hired people that didn't know anything about running a clinic like this and then didn't train them and urged the staff to allegedly schedule as many as 8 patients per hour. And there's just lots of indications of improprieties in that would point to this being some sort of pill mill. What do you say about all these indications of evidence, even though I'm hearing that the non-doctors who were defendants was not responsible for any of this?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, there's a big difference between poorly managing a company and being a criminal. And I think that the government has presented evidence, and there's no dispute that this company was mismanaged in some ways. We could look at it and scrutinize it now. So maybe Mr. Tyndale is a poor manager. Maybe he should have done a better job, but that's a far cry from being involved in a pill mill drug conspiracy. The court is presented with a number of facts, and Mr. Samuel touched upon a number of these, in which they did put regulations into place to try to curb drug abuse, to try to get control of the fact that people are abusers of these drugs. That can't be denied, but TPI took efforts in order to try to curb this and made efforts that Mr. Samuel just described, and I'm happy to describe even more, in which they tried to curb the drug abuse, to try to put regulations in. They turned people down. They discharged people. Clearly, it wasn't enough, but there were regulations put into place to try to be a safety net.
It doesn't sound like many precautions were being taken by the management of the clinic. If you were not taking cash because you don't want to make large cash deposits and requiring prepaid debit cards from the people coming for the pills and all that sort of thing, there are indications of suspicious activities there. And of course, the jury heard all of these things. So it would seem that on appeal, you would want to tell us what were the legal errors, what's the evidence that was presented to the jury that was shouldn't have been admitted, or what was erroneous about the trial and that sort of thing. So far, I'm not hearing much, at least on oral argument.
Your Honor, these illegal acts, that these other acts that the government put forth, could have easily been something that tipped the scales. That we think it is so important and so prejudicial to Mr. Tyndale, because it let the jury know that these other acts were relevant. But unfortunately, they were unduly prejudicial. The district court didn't properly weigh the evidence, didn't properly do any 403 balancing. And this resulted in a trial that led to the admission of evidence that was completely out of the realm of what should have been presented. And that did prejudice Mr. Tyndale. And it clouded the jury's ability to hear about all these positives. And therefore, we ask this court to find that the district court committed reversible error in admitting this other act evidence and failure to properly analyze the issue. And as a result, Mr. Tyndale's conviction should be vacated. Thank you.
All right. Just now, Mr. Schrod, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kevin Shad appearing for Dr. Timothy Gowder. Yes. And I would like to focus the court's attention this afternoon on one of the issues which I raised in my brief, and that is that with regards to the sufficiency of the evidence relating to the two money laundering counts. And these two money laundering counts that Dr. Gowder was convicted of are not the classic disguise or conceal money laundering counts. These are 18 U.S.C. section 1957 money laundering, which is basically that you take criminally derived property and that you engage in a monetary transaction with that criminally derived property. You know it's criminally derived and the amount's in excess of $10,000. And we have a couple separate arguments as to why the evidence is legally insufficient to convict Dr. Gowder on either of these counts. The first one is that the indictment alleged and the crime was charged in the Eastern District of Kentucky, but the evidence that was presented at trial by the government showed that the crime entirely occurred within the state of Tennessee. There's two basic checks, and the two checks in question that are the alleged money laundering are Dr. Gowder's paychecks for the week. They provided the jury with every check that was written to Dr. Gowder. And it was obvious that these two checks were amongst a lot of checks that were basically his pay for each week of his performance of his duties at the pain clinic. So these two checks are important to the government because they happen to exceed the $10,000 threshold. And that's why they thought they could be charged under 1957. The problem is the checks were written in the state of Tennessee from a state of Tennessee bank, provided to Dr. Gowder in Tennessee, and cashed and or deposited in his account in the state of Tennessee. They had no connection whatsoever. The monetary transaction had no connection whatsoever to the Eastern District of Kentucky. And that's important for a couple reasons, because the government tries to argue in its brief that, well, there was a drug conspiracy, the drug conspiracy bled into Kentucky, and therefore that gives us jurisdiction in the Eastern District of Kentucky to charge these crimes. If you take a look at the indictment in the case, the superseding indictment is record number 59. They actually allege in these two counts, not only that these transactions occurred in the state of Tennessee or state of Kentucky, the Eastern District of Kentucky, but that they incurred in Knox County in the Eastern District of Kentucky. That's what the superseding indictment alleges. And we know from the facts that they presented at trial that everything occurred with regards to these two checks in the state of Tennessee. The Pechlikoff case that I cite to in my brief says that when you're taking a look at where a crime should be charged, you have one of two options. Either it's where the transaction or where the crime occurred, and or if the statute has a venue component to it, that overrides where the crime occurred. Now, in this case, 1957, they does have a venue component. It's contained in 1956 I think it's subsection A. And that says that in order for a venue to be proper in the state that you're in, the district that you're charging, that it either the transaction had to have occurred in that district, which it didn't in this case, or the defendant in the underlying criminal conduct, the defendant participated in the transfer of proceeds from the underlying criminal conduct to the district where it's being charged. So the government was required to prove under 1956 under the venue component of the statute that either number one, the transaction occurred in the Eastern District of Kentucky, or that my client, Dr. Gowder, was involved in the transaction that actually occurred and that it went into or out of that jurisdiction. There was obviously no evidence presented by the government that happened, because it in fact never did happen. Again, this was simply two checks that were drawn from the state of Tennessee to the state of Tennessee that were his paychecks for the two time periods in question. Therefore, on that basis alone, the both of those convictions must be overturned. We also have an argument that we've raised with regards to whether or not the government ever provided sufficient evidence that there were, in fact, criminally derived property. And the statute reads that the criminally derived property, there has to be criminally derived property, and that the funds have to have a value of greater than $10,000. Our argument is that they never proved where any of the $10,000 that are comprises these two checks came from, and did not prove that they were, number one, criminally derived property, but more than that, that they were criminally derived property from the state Eastern District of Kentucky, which they would have had to have proved in that case. The government presented evidence that there were on 42 out of 900 patients that were involved in Kentucky. That's the evidence that they presented. They cannot show you that $10,000 came from the Eastern District of Kentucky, or again, that my client was involved in its transfer in any way, shape, or form. I see that my time is up. Unless the court has any questions, we would ask that you overturn those two convictions on those bases.
All right, we'll hear from Mr. Carson. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Jay Carson for James Bradley Combs. Mr. Combs raises two main issues on appeal. The first, like some of the other defendants, is the admission of evidence of material that was unfairly prejudicial and had little probative value. Most specifically, a jailhouse recording. To give some background on Mr. Combs, Mr. Combs is not a doctor. Mr. Combs is not a business person. Mr. Combs was not an employee of TCI. Mr. Combs was unfortunately an addict. He was arrested for possession of oxycodone, charged with possession and intent to distribute. He was also charged as being part of the conspiracy and being a sponsor for persons going to these clinics. Now, he was found not guilty on the conspiracy charge. And indeed, that's quite sensible because the only evidence that was presented was that he occasionally carpooled with people to pain clinics and that he recommended them. Yet this jailhouse conversation in which Mr. Combs, it goes as you think many jailhouse conversations might go, he is quite candid. The conversation is with his girlfriend. It is profanity laced. And in it, he discusses another man, a man named Holland, who had, according to Mr. Combs, seduced his wife in the past and was now making advances towards his girlfriend. Mr. Combs, at numerous times throughout the phone call, referred to Mr. Holland as a rat. He called him a cheese eater. And he used some adjectives between those to heighten the effect. His counsel objected to this admission of this evidence in that, one, it was hardly probative of the counts he was being charged with, a conspiracy to run an alleged pill mill, or simple possession with intent to distribute. But the court allowed the evidence in as evidence of consciousness of Mr. Combs's guilt. Now, the issue there, of course, is Mr. Combs had a substantial history with Mr. Holland, and calling him a rat and the numerous other names that he called him could well have been attributed to his past history, rather than any belief that Mr. Holland had ratted him out, which is the story that the government wanted to impress upon the jury. Given that, further, Mr. Holland, who was the alleged person who made these signed statements or allegedly put Mr. Combs into jail, was never called as a witness. His statements did not become part of the record. His statements did not become part of the prosecutorial complaint. So the idea that there's really any probative value to Mr. Combs's comments in jail about Mr. Holland would seem to be fleeting. More so, the when you consider weighing against that under 403B, the prejudice that Mr. Combs suffered because of that. The jury found out he was in jail. The jury saw him as a convict. They heard him speaking foul language. He at one point referenced violence towards another inmate who had also been accused of raping his girlfriend. So the court erred in admitting this evidence because it was overwhelmingly prejudicial. The error was compounded then in Mr. Combs' sentencing in that the jailhouse phone call was used as evidence that Mr. Combs was threatening a witness and also had committed perjury. The idea of perjury being that, well, he must have been conscious of his guilt if he said that someone was a rat. Finally, the other piece in the sentencing, which Mr. Combs believes was improper, is that the government alleged and the court apparently accepted that Mr. Combs made money selling drugs, when in fact there was no evidence that Mr. Combs was selling drugs. Rather, it is sadly that he was an addict. If And I see my time has expired.
All right. Thank you very much. I guess we'll hear from the government at this point.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Lauren Tanner Bradley for the United States. With respect to Mr. Mithivani's arguments, you don't need to be a doctor to know that this was a pill mill. Mr. Samuels stated, Mr. Mithivani was involved in the early staffing of this operation. That staff was inexperienced in the clinical setting. I believe that Julie Hankins had previously worked in fast food services. He was also involved in the hiring of doctors. These doctors were qualified only in the sense that they had a medical license. Dr. Gowder had been an OBGYN for 30 years prior to working at this clinic. He had no prior pain management experience. That's also true for the hiring of other doctors, including the doctors at the Murphy Clinic that were considered. So, for example, Dr. Manning, who Mithivani and Tyndale approached as early as April of 2016, that would be before Dr. Gowder actually entered into the agreed order with the Tennessee Medical Board, that they began recruiting Dr. Manning, and Dr. Manning had no prior experience in pain management. That's also true for Dr. McDonald, who actually worked at the Murphy Clinic, and also true for Dr. Long, who worked at the Murphy Clinic. Dr. Long himself was also facing other issues with his medical license, where he was not even able to actually issue prescriptions at the time that that clinic began. And I'm glad that the court was able to talk so much about this Murphy Clinic, because that is actually some of the best evidence that Mithivani was aware of this operation, that he had agreed to violate the drug laws. Basically, he was fully aware of the Tennessee Medical Board investigation that had gone on for 3 years. It had started in 2013. So this was an ongoing proceeding for the doctors. They had paid over $233,000 in lawyer fees in defending against those actions. And once those actions were concluded and the doctors were going to surrender their licenses, Mithivani and Tyndale decided to move this operation to North Carolina, where the laws were less strict. That again began before the Tennessee agreed orders were actually entered in the record. And this also occurred after the DEA raided TPI's offices. And again, they were looking at doctors that had no chronic pain management experience. And there was I believe that Mr. Samuel said that there was not evidence of illegality at the Murphy Clinic, but in fact there was. Actually, we had multiple patients testify that this clinic was engaged in doctor shuffling. So the first doctor that was hired, Dr. McDonald, she was not seeing patients quickly enough, not prescribing enough oxycodone for these patients. And so they actually hired other doctors. And there's evidence that the Murphy Clinic actually reached out to TPI patients to let them know that they had gotten a new doctor and that that doctor would issue comparable prescriptions. And that is
Were there any standards or requirements that this clinic had for the doctors that it hired in terms of credentials or medical licensure or prior work experience or anything like that? Did they vet these doctors or in any meaningful way?
There's no evidence that they were vetting these doctors in a meaningful way. And I believe Dr. Randall J. Long testified, and also Mr. Thurston, who was essentially a headhunter for them, testified that they just needed a doctor. They were not looking for someone with specific chronic pain management experience. And Dr. Long also had emailed with Mr. Mithivani and Tyndale with respect to Dr. McDonald asking, well, are we sure that she prescribes narcotics? So again, all of this points to Mithivani's knowledge. I will also note that we already spoke a little bit about the profit margin of the clinic. This was a highly profitable enterprise for Mr. Mithivani. The clinic, it was testified that it had a 47% profit margin. He made over just under $2 million over the course of 2012 to 2016. And I will also note that Mr. Mathiviani was in Florida most of the time, but he was not an absent owner. There was testimony that he was in daily communication with the staff. He put forth procedures and rules and policies. And this is something that Mr. Mathiviani is trying to say that I was trying to curb pill-seeking behavior, but these rules did nothing to curb pill-seeking behavior. They simply acted to deter law enforcement detection. There was also reference to referrals. The referrals was really a part of TPI's practices of simply papering a file, and that actually is a hallmark of pill mills. This is something that Agent Dalrymple testified to, that frequently a pill mill will ask for patients to provide an MRI, a doctor referral, they'll do pill counts, drug screens, all for the sake of papering a file, but to no effect. This is not something that the doctors were acting upon. It's not information that the doctors were using in their diagnoses. In fact, that is something that in the Tennessee agreed order, Dr. Gowder says that he agrees that he was not using any of this information to inform his prescribing practices. Something else that was mentioned is the complaints. Mr. Mathiviani, there was testimony that he did in fact look at these complaints. The complaints that were introduced into the record, I believe was over 100 pages of complaints about patients. And these patients, once a complaint would be lodged, it wasn't as if this led to a discharge. Typically what would happen is, this was something that the clinic kept tabs on, but did nothing about until something actually threatened the clinic. So Tanya Couch is a patient. She testifies that she had multiple bad pill counts, multiple bad drug screens, and that Dr. Gowder actually discussed a patient complaint with her in 2013, but she wasn't discharged from the clinic until 2015 when she was publicly arrested. And that's very consistent with drug trafficking, that drug traffickers typically don't want to work with people who've recently been picked up by police officers for fear of them informing. And that's also consistent with patient Petri and also patient, Laura McKnight is another patient, where these are all individuals who are not discharged despite lots of evidence of pill-seeking behavior, pill and actual diversion.
Counsel, there's one aspect here wherein it's alleged that people who were purchasing these pills from the clinic some of the patients had an organized conspiracy in that they would turn around and sell those pills to make money for themselves. And I guess the jury would have heard about these overlapping conspiracies. Would that have had the potential for confusion or prejudice that there was more than one, allegedly more than one conspiracy involved here?
There was evidence, I think you might be referring to the evidence about the Gosnells, who were going to TPI obtaining prescriptions and then selling them. That is not a separate conspiracy. That is a part of the conspiracy. That would be essentially chain distribution, where you have your drug source, middlemen, and then local dealers. So it's very typical for all of those individuals to be prosecuted in the same case, in the same trial, and occasionally for prosecutorial discretion reasons, they might be separated. But the evidence with respect to the Gosnells is just a part of the chain distribution that was being engaged in between the clinic, the patient, and then the local dealers, the local buyers.
All right.
Counsel, let me ask you about Mr. Shad's argument on venue. So as I understood it, he was saying that Dr. Gowder, there's insufficient evidence to convict insufficient evidence to show venue for prosecuting under the money laundering statute because the two checks were written in Tennessee, deposited in Tennessee. What's your response to that? What evidence would allow there to be venue to prosecute Dr. Gowder for money laundering in the Eastern District of Kentucky.
Well, with respect to the venue argument, Gowder, Dr. Gowder, is participating in drug trafficking in Kentucky. He's engaging in illicit activity in the Eastern District of Kentucky. He is providing Eastern Kentucky patients with prescriptions for oxycodone. Frequently, these prescriptions were actually filled in Kentucky and then diverted in Kentucky. And so in that way, Dr. Gowder is linked to these sales that are occurring in Kentucky. And what he's being charged with under 1957 is that he is being charged with causing these proceeds from these drug sales, illicit drug trafficking sales, to then be transported back to Tennessee and then deposited with healthcare managers and then eventually deposited in Gowder's own bank account. And so that certainly qualifies as participation in the transfer of proceeds underneath the statute. And again, this is a preponderance of the evidence standard based on the considerable evidence that Kentucky drug dealers were coming to TPI, using it as a source of oxycodone, selling that oxycodone in Kentucky, and then transferring those proceeds. That a juror can reasonably infer establishes venue here.
So the proceeds go beyond just what Dr. Gowder was personally paid? Is that your argument, that it would encompass all of the revenue of the pain clinic?
Yes, he is participating in that transfer of proceeds. And then with respect to the additional argument about whether or not these are Kentucky proceeds, 50% of this clinic's clientele was from Kentucky. So 50%, you know, a jury could reasonably infer that 50% of the proceeds, which in total were $8.1 million in receipts to healthcare managers over the course of the conspiracy, that approximately 50% of those proceeds are from Kentucky. And then healthcare managers funnels those into four separate accounts, one of which is TPIP's account. And then that is from where Dr. Gowder's paycheck comes. And all of these accounts are primarily funded by customer payments for prescriptions.
And there, and your contention is there's a sufficient evidence to show that there was more than $10,000 in drug purchases from Kentucky?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes, substantially more than $10,000. And this is where the tracing argument comes in to some extent, because once those Kentucky payments are joined, commingled with other payments, there's no way to differentiate between the two and actually determine one from the other. But here, you know, the majority of courts don't require us to actually trace which specific payment was included in that $10,000 of proceeds, when there's substantial evidence that all of the proceeds from this operation were criminally derived. I think that was what the evidence showed. I think Mr. Chad mentioned, you know, 42 files were examined. It wasn't just 42 files that were examined. Dr. Easton looked at 42 files. 100% of those files showed illegitimate prescribing practices. The Tennessee Medical Board reviewed 50 files. 100% of those files showed illegitimate prescribing practices. The government put on at least 7 patients. 100% of those patients showed illegitimate prescribing habits. So over the course of the evidence, you're looking at approximately 100 patients, 100% of whom received illegitimate prescriptions. And then on top of that, you have the PMP data, which shows that 67% of the dosages being given out by this clinic were for oxycodone. When you include Xanax and oxymorphone in that, it reaches 90% of the dosage units that TPI actually prescribed. So I think based on all of that evidence, it is overwhelming evidence that this was a criminal enterprise full through. With respect to Mr. Tyndale's arguments, I'll address this very quickly, that this other act idea, the judge ruled correctly that this was intrinsic proof of the conspiracy. This conspiracy originated in Florida. That is where Mr. Tyndale gained the knowledge, the know-how, informed the plan to open a pill mill closer to his patients. He had a patient list. It was primarily from Kentucky and Tennessee. And so he moved his operation closer to those patients. And then I will also address the idea of Mr. Combs. I believe it was said that there wasn't a lot of evidence with respect to him actually selling oxycodone. And there is quite a bit of evidence that he was involved in drug trafficking. I believe that there was testimony that he had hundreds of pills in his residence in the basement that day, that it was more than a mere user amount, that he had multiple phones that would be consistent with drug trafficking, scales also consistent with drug trafficking, bags of syringes, and there were also text messages indicating distribution, and also Venus Barnett actually testified that she had purchased pills from Mr. Combs. With respect to the incriminating phone calls, the idea that he is referring to Hatfield and Will Holland as rats, I think that the implication, the clear implication of that is that there is something to be ratted about. Ms. Hatfield is actually the one who was the reason that law enforcement came to his basement that day and found all those pills. I don't know if there are any further questions, if there's anything else the court would like me to address, but if there are not, I will rest on my brief.
Very well. We'll have rebuttal, if there is any, first from Mr. Lazarus.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I just want to address 2 points quickly. First of all, the government, towards the end of their argument, referenced the R404B challenge and the judge's order. And despite the judge's conclusions in this case, the judge never engaged in the 403 balancing that's required by the rule and required by this court's precedent. And the court's failure to do so constituted an abuse of discretion requiring this court to reverse. Secondly, the government also brings up this idea that there were rules to put into place that they were simply done just to evade law enforcement, that the evidence shows otherwise. And I point the court to page 40 of my brief, where we have a laundry list of things that TPI did, things put into place by Mr. Tyndale and by Mr. Mithiviani to put into place to try to curb drug abuse. And the most significant number that to me that stands out is the testimony of Julie Hankins, who said that between 2011 and 2013, TPI discharged 430 patients. These are patients that they decided that they didn't want their money, that they wanted to get rid of because they weren't following the rules. This is a substantial number and shows that they weren't just doing it just to check a box or just to throw law enforcement off the scent, but 430 patients over 2 years and years before the law enforcement was ever even involved. This number has significance, and it shows that these were not artificial policies put into place, but were real substantive things that the defendants were trying to do to try to follow the rules. Now, as the court's aware, they may not have been the best at it, and they may not have been very good at it, but there's a far cry from what they've done in the mismanagement and being involved in a criminal conspiracy. And therefore, we ask this court to vacate the convictions, and we would rest there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shad, do you have any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honors, the government would win the venue argument if you only read half of the statute. So 1956 little I is the venue portion of the money laundering statute. And it says that you can bring a money laundering charge in, quote, any district where a prosecution for the underlying specified unlawful activity could be brought, which, again, that's the government's argument. The underlying activity is in the Eastern District of Kentucky. Therefore, we can bring money laundering counts in the Eastern District of Kentucky. But it goes on. The statute goes on. They ask you to stop reading there. It says, if the defendant participated in the transfer of the proceeds of the specified unlawful activity from that district to the district where the financial or monetary transaction is conducted. So Dr. Gowder would have, in order for them to rely on that part of the statute, Dr. Gowder would have had to participated in the transfer of the proceeds from the Eastern District of Kentucky to Tennessee where the monetary transaction occurred. And that's where the government loses on this case. And that's where we ask that the court overturn both convictions with regards to this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I think we're ready to have the case submitted. And the case hereby is submitted. The clerk can conclude our proceedings. I believe we don't have any further cases for argument, so court may be adjourned.
This honorable court is now adjourned. Counsel, you may disconnect.
Thank you.